Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel, and proud member of the Robots Radio Podcast Network. My name is Aramithius, and this week we are asking no questions in particular and lots of questions in general. This week is the first interview on Written in Uncertainty, and I'm very excited to say it was a chat with the ESO Loremaster, Leman Tuttle. It was an absolutely fantastic conversation, got cut a little short thanks to technical difficulties at the end, so it does end a little abruptly. I am sorry for that. It was an absolute pleasure to have Leman on and chat about how lore is presented, how the truth and sequence was written, how he thinks about character, and interweaving various ideas into the lore that gets written. So I'm just going to let you guys listen to that interview in a few seconds, although I do have a specific disclaimer to make. In addition to my own usual one of this is my own opinion and not necessarily the truth of it, Leman wants to add his own to this, that it's what we talk about is his own opinion, his own interpretation, and that not even anything from the Loremaster himself is a definitive answer on anything. Because of the way that the Elder Scrolls lore is presented and gone through and to an extent worked on by a lot of people as well, getting definitive answers isn't something that's going to happen even when we have a chat with the Loremaster. So we get Leman's perspective on a lot of fantastic stuff, but please do not take this as definitive answers anywhere. And with that, I will hand you over to the interview. So, Leman, thank you very much for joining me and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. Glad to be here.
So I just thought we'd go ridiculously broad to start with, just to set the scene and just get used to what we're talking about. I wanted to talk about thought processes and how things are seen more than anything else, but just to set the scene, what is lore to you in the games? You are now master of lore, so what is your kingdom?
Oh, geez. first of all, it's not my kingdom. The kingdom belongs to many, many people, but I don't know. I mean, it's the really, really important stuff that kind of happens underneath, you know, the basic activities. So it's kind of the context in which everything happens. And I think that it's cool to really dig into that stuff because, I mean, if you're creating a living world, if you're, you know, a world that people actually inhabit, they have to have stuff to talk about, you know, they have to have, you know, shared cultural narratives and, you know, things that they can all, you know, be able to speak intelligently to each other in a way that makes sense. So, I think it's really, really cool. It's one of the coolest parts of the franchise. It's exciting to be a part of it for sure.
Well, that's a suitably broad answer to kick things off with, I suppose. But the way you're talking about it, it sounds like you're trying to conceive of the lore as the way that the characters experience the things in the game world,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so.
But how does that perspective, which is incredibly broad, I mean, it's not just this is the story or whatever, how does that perspective inform how you write about Tamriel or Nirn, just to keep it even broader?
Yeah, I mean, well, with respect to Elder Scrolls generally, or specifically, it's tremendously important because everything that the player gets is through the lens of one of those characters, right? There's nobody outside of the game saying, you know, it's XYZ and that's just how it is or whatever. So you have to have a really solid understanding of how people in that universe think, because that's how you're getting the information. So, it kind of feeds on itself. It's like you have to know the lore in order for the people who in the game who know the lore to explain the lore. You know, it's like this weird kind of cyclical thing. But it's neat.
And just thinking about needing to be able to think about it in that sort of a way, and what does that mean for how you think about the process of making lore? This is possibly getting a bit of ahead of ourselves from the questions, but I just thought this was too good a segue to ignore.
Sure.
But when you say think about what they're thinking about and how they're thinking about it, that, but one character in the lore says they're seeing a circle and one character in the lore says they're seeing a square.
Right.
Is there a cylinder behind that? Is there some sort of
I'm trying to describe something visually. Yeah,
I mean, words, are you talking about like, you know, like sort of a pan Tamrielic shared narrative kind of thing? Like, yeah. I mean, there's things like, you know, like the monomyth or whatever that is kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, kind of sets the table. It's sort of the you know, that everybody kind of is adjacent to, right? Yeah. You might not necessarily be on the same page with how it all is laid out, but there's kind of like a kind of a shared basis of basic cosmological ideas that everything kind of taps into. So in that way, yeah, I mean, even if you're looking at things and you're looking at them in a completely different way, you know, I think that cultures are able to understand each other even when those differences are pretty big, you know. So yeah,
that's interesting, because I know that for the Elder Scrolls 3 Morrowind's development particularly, there were some competing philosophies in how the game was going to be developed. There were some people that saying that there has to be some sort of shared narrative in, say, the Battle for Red Mountain is what I'm thinking about, that there need to be these touchstones that had to have happened, and this needs to reference this and needs to reference this. And then there were some other writers that were then saying that they need to, they go away and write a bunch of stuff that wasn't necessarily related, and regardless of how the contradictions kind of fell out. But it sounds like from your perspective that you've still got that common core that's then being drawn from by everyone. Is that a reasonable description?
I guess so. It's tough to say because I'm a very big proponent in real life of, you know, hey, there is truth, right? There is a thing that's, you know, you can pile stuff on top of it, but at the end of the day, there's this hard nugget of actual stuff that, you know, we're all trying to get to or whatever. And it's a little bit more loosey-goosey in Elder Scrolls, you know, because it is a fictional universe, right? I think it's tough to say, you know, there is a specific discrete truthful event that happened and we're all kind of, you know, getting at it because it didn't actually happen, you know, it's a fictional event. It's a little tougher. In real life though, yeah, I think that there's absolutely a, you know, a truth that we're all kind of getting a glimpse of. And
And just thinking about how that truth gets presented, the Antiquity system is an absolutely fantastic way of doing that and of merging lore and gameplay in a way that we haven't really seen before in the games. And when you were trying to conceptualize the types of lore that you could develop for that, what was the thought processes? And I don't really want to say the word limit, but that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I mean, it's... There was kind of, so we wanted to do two things. We wanted to kind of expand on the stuff that people are really passionate about and they know a lot about, right? Like Alessian stuff. And I mean, the things that people have been asking to see for a very long time, but hadn't actually seen yet. So there was that. And then there was also, there's like, let's show people things that they have never seen before that, you know, that there isn't a whole lot of underlying lore behind, and so you've got you know, the kind of familiar and the unfamiliar, and it was a lot of people worked on it. Andrew Young actually created most of the list of the things that we should be looking at, you know, he kind of batted around and said, oh, this could be cool and this could be cool, we hope to keep adding to it. So hopefully there's going to be more and more cool things that you can throw in your house or wear or whatever. I mean, in terms of limits, there are definitely things that we want to keep a mystery as much as possible. So, we had bounced some ideas around of things where we're like, ooh, it could be this. And then we're like, no, we can't do that. I'm happy with the list of things that we put out. I think people really dig them. I remember going on to Twitter kind of the day after it all came out, and everybody was like losing their minds, like, oh my god, did you see the Alessia statue or whatever? And it was really cool. It was really rewarding. Everybody was really happy.
One of the things that fascinated me is that is that it's a different type of lore that's being put through, that things like, well, for this podcast, it's framed around the big questions, the deep stuff in inverted commas.
Right, yeah.
That's these big cosmic mysteries and so on. And it feels like Antiquities is almost going entirely the opposite direction.
Right.
It's going into the day-to-day details of life and the kind of day-to-day ceremonial and the way that people's lives are lived in a way that we haven't really seen that much before in how the lore's been presented.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think I was a history major, history and philosophy major when I was in college. And history is all about, you get the big themes, but it's also all about the mundane stuff, right? It's because that's your window into that world, right? So we do it with the Steelies too, in terms of, just stuff that you find around the house when you're, robbing somebody blind or whatever, that can give you a pretty good look into Tamrielic life or whatever. But I really like getting to the kind of like nitty gritty, like, kind of hard specific stuff about like, is this a statue of, Boethra, or it's a statue of, so-and-so. And it's like, that's cool, but what is it made of? Right. Like, who made it? Like, what is it? Those are the kinds of questions that I think are really interesting, because, not only do they give you a better sense of, what's going on in the world, but they also make things more real, because, you got to think about that stuff. I think you want to get into these huge things, and then, you got to have that strong foundation at the bottom, or else it doesn't feel real.
Yeah, that's something that I found that several fantasy universes will kind of skip out, if you like. There'll be the creation myths and the big cosmologies, mm-hmm. and there'll be dragons. But at the end of the day, how do they make bricks?
Right, exactly. And I think there's two schools of thought. Both are like tremendously flawed. Like, one of them is like, as a writer, I'm going to focus strictly on these huge themes, and it's going to be unbelievable. It's going to blow your mind. And then, like you said, there's no floor to that.
Mm.
Or you can do like me sometimes and get so caught up in like, how do you make bricks, that you spend like hours looking at brick making, and then it's was that really relevant? Like, did we need to know everything about making bricks? It's still, I think they inform each other. I think you need both in order
absolutely.
To make a compelling universe, for sure.
Yeah, I've seen arguments made about that, actually. And there's a quote that's not complimentary about Glorantha that kind of highlights exactly that, that you absolutely do need both mixed together. And thinking about the voice of Antiquities, so to speak, you've already said that you've got the little descriptions of all the objects in ESO already. Are there any particular challenges that came up with that particular writing style or implementing those sorts of voices that came up during Antiquities development?
Yeah, when we were talking about who is actually going to write these things, there was a lot of debate about, what kind of perspectives do we want to give. Because the historian's perspective informs a lot of what they're going to say. So originally it was, we had like two people, and we were like, no, it's got to be more people than that. Because two people is not going to work. So it kind of steadily increased. And then we ended up with the five major voices that you have, which is Gabrielle, Verda, Amalian, and then, the other two guys. Anyway, there's an interplay there, and we try to give them each kind of a unique area of expertise. Ugron is, he's an orc, so he has a very orcish perspective, but he's also, he's a scholar as well. So, he's not like the stereotypical, bang a drum, grunt kind of orcish perspective. So he can provide a very unique perspective on all this stuff, because the orcish way of life is different than all the other stuff. And then you have Amalian, who's got she has the Mirish perspective, where she's able to, and she's also kind of the weirdo, which is kind of like, very thinly veiled, kind of like avatar for me and some of the other lore beards at the studio. It's like, oh man, we're talking about this really crazy thing. So there's her, and then you have you know, Gabrielle has the more magey kind of arcane history sort of stuff. So everybody kind of comes at it from a different angle. And when you have those competing worldviews kind of having good faith arguments, which is what those things are supposed to be, you know, that'll give you hopefully kind of a more nuanced understanding of what that item is. It's not, you know, it's not the capital T truth of what that item is, but it gives you, you know, kind of a approach it from multiple angles and, you know, kind of make your own decision sort of thing. So.
And now I think about it, that was already there to a degree with Phrastus and, oh, I'm forgetting her name now.
Lady Cinnabar, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, same deal. And I think that's essential to Elder Scrolls, because I think that sometimes, because we have these ideas that, I mean, some of us have been forming for decades at this point, you know, about, I think it should be this, and then they're like, here's a pen, write books. I think there's an issue. It's like, I can finally write all the crazy stuff I've been thinking all these years. And it's like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. Yeah. So I think that having those dialogues between characters, it helps you balance out, you know, saying my personal opinion, my personal ideas are not that important. What's important is, you know, these characters kind of battling it out, coming to, you know, consensus or not. And then ultimately that kind of invites other people into that conversation, which I think is that's when you succeeded, you've taken a conversation between two characters and you've invited the larger lore community to participate. And I think we've done that pretty well for the most part.
Yeah, that's something that I think I've noticed a bit more with the texts of the Elder Scrolls in general. In previous games, there were books, well, I mean, there still are, and they're penned by anonymous. Yep. And there's nothing else that makes me more angry when I'm trying to work out.
Yeah, that's got to be frustrating.
Yes. Yep, exactly. It's, I don't know, it's, it might be that some of the texts are coming from an earlier era where there was a bit more of a tendency to put something that was word of godish, if I can put it that way.
Right, yeah.
I like when I can say that this is definitely where those ideas come from, and it's really nice to see Antiquities growing that sort of idea.
Yeah.
And are you going to be adding any more voices to the choir for Antiquities as you go on?
Yeah, I can't talk about that specifically. I mean,
sure.
there's always a possibility that it will expand. The University of Gwillim, which they're all faculty of or whatever, it's a big organization. There's lots of different, you know, people all over Tamriel. So, you know, it's possible. We are definitely going to be providing more antiquities for people to find as new zones emerge. So there's always going to be more stuff to do and to find, which is cool.
Are there any other universities on Tamriel now I think about it? Because I saw the University of Gwillim getting associated with this, and it seems to have its fingers in a lot of pies, all originally developed off the back of one text that talks about the movements of men across Cyrodiil, if I remember correctly. But it seems to be the only real, what I would call, academic institution as such on Tamriel. Am I missing some somewhere?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's you've got the College of the Sapiarchs. So yep. You've got there are other universities. I think that the Gwillim guys have they basically have universal appeal, which is why they're, you know, everybody's invited in a way that some of the other universities are a little bit more, you know, at arm's length.
Yeah, it feels the most university-like, if I can put it that way, because I wouldn't necessarily have put the College of Sapiarchs in the same category because of how they deal with their knowledge.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
And thinking about that, the University of Gwillim already existed before Antiquities, and I think the College of Sapiarchs already existed. But how does having that existing context within the lore impact the kind of things you can introduce with in terms of new antiquities or new books? What does the existing context give you in terms of constraints and opportunities?
In terms of how we present that information, or
and the types of information you can develop, both.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that there are limitations in terms of what scholarly practice in Tamriel, how that's different from us. You know, like, I mean, there are, you know, types of, you know, there's no engineers in the universe. Well, I mean, there might be. There are certain schools or things that they don't necessarily need, I guess, in Tamriel. But I mean, you know, there are architects and there are there's things that they need that we don't, like Daedrology and, you know, other types of classes that, you know, obviously not something that we need to worry about. But we always have to keep in mind about, you know, you don't want things to be anachronistic, and you don't want want to kind of enforce modern sensibilities on how they're studying, because it's different. But I mean, they're you know, the they have all the, you know, they have a lot of theologies, you know. I don't know if that answers your question.
I was thinking about it in a bit more of a meta perspective as to how the lore is produced, because you've already got this huge great world. Mundus is already there and with a relatively established timeline as such. So how does that context inform the kind of stuff you can develop?
In terms of the timeline, everything has to take place before 582.
Well,
there's lots of like fun, heady stuff that we can't really talk about. Like, we can't talk about Tiber Septim or, any of the stuff that comes later, you know? I'm trying to follow your question. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah. I'm sometimes bad at explaining.
No, it's okay. I'm bad at explaining things sometimes.
No, it's just that you've kind of got this really rich tapestry that's already there. And so how do you add new stitches, so to speak, without changing the entire picture?
I gotcha. Yeah. There's so much space. There's so much space on the tapestry. Like, if you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
And, if you just look at any like First Empire, that's a lot of time. That's Second Empire, that's a long amount of time. And we don't know all the sovereigns, we don't know all their stories, we don't know, you know, there's huge gaps that you can work in. And some of those things are places that people have visited, like Clockwork City. I mean, you know, there's a lot about Clockwork City, but even with all the stuff that was already in place, I mean, there's still a ton of room for, you know, jazz and, you know, looking around and seeing, you know, digging deeper into exactly what's going on. Also, like with places like Black Marsh, I mean, it's, you know, how many people have gone to Hellstrom? You know, there's who knows what's going on in there. So there's definitely a lot of space to explore, for sure. I don't think we're ever going to run out.
Nope.
That's
fair enough. It might just be my own biases then, because I tend to think in terms of ideas, and so I just think this idea has been played out or explored and has however many existing perspectives, so can we really add anything more that's meaningful to that idea is what I kind of go to. But that's probably just my own way of looking at things. And as we kind of come to ideas, like one of the big things that's been on your CV while you've worked at ZOS has been you created Sophocil as a character, and you've mentioned in the past that hard determinism is one of those ideas that you wanted to get into Sophocil and explore.
Yeah.
And this is probably going to be the kind of meat and bones of the interview because, well, it's Sophocil, so yeah.
I know you dug it. I listened to your whole podcast series on it. I was like, wow, man, that's nuts.
So. Were there any other ideas that you wanted to get into Sophocil? Any other perspectives or theories or... I'll stop throwing words at you now.
No, it's all good. Yes, absolutely. Like I said, I was a philosophy major in college, and I'm very much the opinion that, like, there's important stuff that we need to talk about in philosophy, and if I wasn't able to find a way to do that, like, I would be miserable at my job, because I do. I mean, that's the stuff I really want to think about. It's the stuff I really want to be talking about. So with Sophocil in specific, there's the hard determinism aspect of it, but there's a lot with Nietzsche that I'm Eternal Recurrence and stuff. I'm a huge Nietzsche fan. For me, everything kind of goes back to Nietzsche eventually, but I know it's not a popular opinion.
Depends
on who you're talking to.
Yeah, but for me, it's a bit more Felix Deleuze, Foucault, those more modern thinkers.
Oh, yeah. There's good stuff there, too.
Yeah.
My buddy, I have a friend of mine who he always gives me a hard time. He's like, Nietzsche's just a lame Schopenhauer. I was like, all right, thanks. You jerk. I disagree.
He's riffing off Schopenhauer, but there's
exactly
some different things going on.
Yeah, that's his point. He's like, if you want to get to the good stuff, just go to skip Nietzsche and go back to Schopenhauer, and then you can skip all his nonsense.
If you want to be depressed all the time, then sure, you go with Schopenhauer. But was it Schopenhauer that wrote On Suffering?
No, On Suffering is Kierkegaard, who's another guy who I thought about in this. Or wait, is it? Oh. Wait, is it not? No, you're right. That is Schopenhauer. I was thinking Second Son to Death. Yeah,
because Schopenhauer can just kind of mope and just be fine, and that's the end of it all. But Nietzsche actually tries to do something.
Yeah, Nietzsche's joyful. He's the joyful destroyer. I love Thus Spoke Zarathustra is like my favorite book ever. To go back, so Nietzsche was a big influence. Plato's Republic was a big influence. I think that comes across pretty clearly.
Oh yeah.
What else? Kierkegaard, his whole Despair of the Infinite stuff, that played a role. There's just a ton of this stuff. I love thinking about all of it. And I think that it's really cool. And I think people would really, they really respond well to it. It's daunting to like, you know, drop, you know, one of those books in somebody's lap and say, you know, read this. And some of those things are not fun to read, right?
Yeah.
But if you present it in a fictional setting with cool, compelling characters, I think people, you know, kind of gives them a foot in the door, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, maybe there's more here to explore, which is part of the reason I love your podcast so much, is because, you're bringing in philosophers, which is like totally my bag. I'm on board. So
excellent. And thinking about how you do that without kind of dumping the whole book on them, so to speak.
Yeah.
What's your process for doing that?
Well, my sister, who is also a philosophy major, she used to joke about how philosophers make poor writers, because you're so caught up in these huge heady ideas that you forget about things like characters and plot. And you have to kind of reel it in sometimes, because I want to go off and talk about really crazy stuff, but at the end of the day, it's really about making compelling characters that people can get behind and kind of get inside their headspace and actually feel for them. So I think if Seth Seal had just waxed on Republic stuff for an hour, people would have just completely tuned out and been like, if you present him as a real person with real priorities and sensitivities that people might not know about, then I think it becomes more compelling. So
that's like dropping stuff from their immediate perspective and their story, and then going straight into the heady stuff, so to speak, like the prisoner dialogue. I thought that was beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Because it's also recognizing that the prisoner is an idea that has been around for quite a while in the series now, actually. And also saying, well, this is how stuff Sophocles Sill does that's relevant to that.
Yeah, I think that's it's an interesting subject. So getting him to kind of dig into that is cool stuff. I dig it.
And thinking about Sophocles Sill in particular, there's an awful lot we get about him that's not necessarily his perspective.
Yeah.
And what went into the development of the Clockwork City and the relation to the Tribunal Faith in general? Because I kind of see those as three distinct things, right? There's Sophocles Sill's perspective, then there's the Clockwork Apostles, and then there's the Tribunal Faith and the Tribunal Temple. How do those three interrelate?
Yeah, I think that there's a fair amount of space between Vivek and Almalexia's adherence too. I mean, that I think kind of gets glossed over sometimes. Seth Seal, because he lives in a completely different place, and his people are specifically explicitly isolated from the world that we know, You don't have the kind of religious cross-pollination that you'd have in actual Tamriel, right? So so they do. They have, I think, necessarily different beliefs because they're just not exposed to anybody else, you know? They're in, you know, dad's big house, and dad's downstairs sometimes, and every so often he shows up and he's like, here's some dad knowledge for you, and I'm going to leave for another 200 years. So I think that they're not starving for new ideas, but I mean, they are very steeped in one specific faith system. And I think that obviously they're told to respect Almalexia and respect Vivek and respect their, you know, their beliefs and how it ties in with Sotha Seal, but they're very explicitly Sotha Seal worshippers. So.
And the way I saw that was that Sotha Seal was collecting back swans, if I can use that expression, that he's kind of taking individuals who are good at something, just kind of plucking them out, and then just smashing them all together to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an experimenting on the experimenters kind of vibe in Clockwork City. I mean, there's a book where Ios talks about, you know, increased sodium content by, you know, X amount. I wonder how many people are going to get, I don't know, diabetes or whatever. You know, it's. You don't get diabetes from sodium. But
yeah, increased you can tell instance of cardiac in
right, exactly. Sort of, so I mean, there's definitely he's up to something that's, you know, kind of above all the stuff that they're up to, and I think that there's a sense that there's definitely an emulation aspect to it where they're, you know, kind of giving themselves mechanical limbs, and they're trying to do experiments of their own, and, you know, they publish theses that like five people will read, and it's definitely a lot of people kind of just like trying to be like Sotha Seal, which I think is, I don't know, I think it's makes sense given the context.
Yeah, and that sort of thing puts a whole different spin on things like the truth and sequence. Like, one of the things that I've heard a lot in the fandom is that it's like the 36 lessons, but for Sotha Seal, which, frankly, no, not at all.
Not at all.
And perhaps the most apt way I've heard of it is that it's one of the best pieces of Sotha Seal fan fiction I've written.
I can see that. It's definitely, I mean, there's definitely a lot of daylight between Vivek stuff and Sotha Seal stuff, though. First of all, on the author, Vivek's unreliable, but at least he's writing himself, right? Like, for Sotha Seal, it's, you know, this person who may have been appointed, may have, you know, just kind of claimed the title of her own, you know, on her own. You've got that, you know, one step away from the truth, which is, you know, that's a big step for someone like Sotha Seal.
That's fair enough. It's been a while. I can't actually remember. Do we ever actually meet Deldries anywhere?
She's been dead for a long time by the time that the player gets there.
Okay. And then gets recycled and religious dogmatism sets in and the rest is, well, clockwork.
Right.
And some of the bits that stood out to me was that there was obviously the kind of the hard determinism and the work like clockwork kind of thing. But you say there's some distance between the truth and sequence and the 36 lessons, but I also saw some commonalities in there. But it's in the stuff that you need to do a bit of digging for. It's in the things like the Anu Padme binary has no merit and that sort of thing.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would be lying if I said, yeah, the 36 lessons had no influence on me. Like, I was just doing my own thing. I mean, if anything, the 36 lessons are so brilliant that I think if I had said I'm gonna do 36 lessons again, it would have been a mess. I think that would be a ridiculous attempt. So it's definitely its own thing, we wanted to present, you know, big crazy, heady cosmological issues in it. So I think we, you know, it's evocative in ways that are similar to the 36 lessons, I guess. There are a lot of, you know, kind of like Zen koans and, you know, weird stuff going on in there. There's definitely similarities, but I did not go in trying to do 36 lessons part two, because that would just be a mess. I love that book series.
I've been asked, do I want to go through that, the 36 lessons, at some point, and
settle in
and just know the New Whirling School's already done a fantastic job on that. I don't know if you've come across them.
I haven't.
Yeah, look them up, newwhirlingschool.com. They've been going for about 3 years or so now, I think.
Wow.
And they're on about sermon 23.
Oh wow, jeez, that's wild, man.
It's just Rotten Deadite and Buckney Boss going through the 36 lessons in whatever spare time they can grab, so
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I admit, when I was going through the Truth and Sequence, I was hoping to do something similar, because you can go to that level of depth with the Truth and Sequence again. So I was just hoping to pull out what was in there. And the Truth and Sequence felt to me a bit more overtly religious, if you like, rather than the mystery text that is 36 Lessons. So while the 36 Lessons is kind of meant to be the sixth circle of mystery and knowledge,
right,
and all
right,
that
right.
stuff, the Truth and Sequence has an awful lot that's in there for the common man, so to speak. So you've got the references to common reference points and exhortations to be your best self and so on, and also to behave and almost try and convert, if I can put it that way, the kind of sense towards the end of, do you really want to be on the losing side?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think most of the people are already converted for the most part, but it's definitely one of these things where, I mean, she's definitely writing to an audience, probably an audience that's on board, already. But, I think that there's something not subtly scary. I think there's something really scary about, where Sothesiel's endeavors are headed, even for people who might be, you know, part of that faith system, right? Like, she doesn't shy away from saying, like, hey, things are going to be different. You know, she talks about how, you know, you have to shed, you know, your idea of self and I and all that other stuff. I mean, it's kind of creepy stuff, you know? I think less than trying to convert people, I think it might just be one of these things where it's like, this is necessary. Don't freak out. Like, you know, look, Sothesiel's got a great plan for everybody. Everything's going to be great, but seriously, stick with the program. It's all going to work out in the end.
Yeah.
You don't want to be like those idiot dwarves or like,
yeah. Yeah, there's just that. It kind of almost feels like scientism, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, yeah,
in the way that it gets put across, because there's the religious trappings in there, which just makes it just so much richer when you just smash those two different worlds together.
Yeah, it's weird, man. It's putting those things together, and also, I mean, kind of there's some stuff about kind of the essential nature of blasphemy. I mean, you know, building blasphemy into the system is that's weird, you know, and tough. And how do you manage that in a way that doesn't just turn into total chaos, you know? So this kind of idea of controlled blasphemy or like controlled chaos inside the system,
which is actually there in 1984. Now I think about it.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
They kind of predict more or less exactly what Winston's going to do.
Yep.
So.
Exactly. So I think you need that, yeah, you need that escape valve, or you need that, you know, you need that built in so you know what's going to happen.
No, absolutely. That's about it for the structured portion of the interview. But apart from Argonians, actually, we haven't talked about Argonians yet. People honestly don't talk about Argonians enough.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Because you've mentioned before that Argonians are one of your favorite races, or maybe the favorite race of yours on Tamriel. Is there a particular reason for that?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I like that they're weird, they're alien, that they have a completely different faith system, a completely different cultural organization, you know, different physiology. I mean, they're just completely other than everybody else on the continent. And I think there's something really, really fascinating about that. And we were given an opportunity to kind of develop some of the specifics of how that society works. And when you take a society and you take the idea of time out of it, like what happens? And I think everything about the Argonians that we've developed it all comes from that kind of central idea of, I mean, that time is far less relevant than most people think it is. And you combine that with their relationship with the Hist, and you get a really interesting culture. That's very, yeah, it's very, very different. So, and I like different things.
Yes. I would almost say though, that it's maybe not time, but it's progress, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was in the latest Selectors Lorecast on Meruns Dagon that we recorded yesterday. We were talking about what Meruns is, and he's more associated with revolution.
Yep.
And I was curious about what the difference is between what Dagon does and what the Hist do with Sithis and with the Argonians, because there's no progress, but there's constant change.
Yeah, exactly. I think Argonians would balk at the idea of revolution because that implies that there's something to revolt against. And for the Argonians, that entire idea is an illusion. There's nothing, there's no thing that you're, you know, rising up against, or, you know, that's the kind of folly that makes all these other people build these giant castles for no reason, because, you know, they're all going to fall down. And, you know, you just time just goes and you just go with it. And whatever happens, happens. And change is inevitable. There's nothing that you can do to really change it, to get in the way of it, or to rebel against it, or to do any of that. You just have to flow with it. And I mean, Sithis as a kind of an avatar of change, I think is, you know, that's their, how they make that connection. It's, you know, I think Shadow Scales are interesting in terms of their relationship with Sithis, but yeah, they just the idea of not so much, I don't know, I feel like revolution, it implies that there's like kind of these like discrete moments in time where, you know, you have to change course, or you have to do something. And it's just, that's not at all the case. All that is an illusion. The only thing that you can maybe say, hey, there was a revolution in history was, you know, the period of transition between, you know, the stone building parts of their history and then the current parts of their history. And we don't know how long that took or why it took place, but I think that the idea that there's these giant stone things that last a really long time, I think that's kind of antithetical to, you know, the basic, you know, basics of their whole mm-hmm. existence.
Yeah. So. My interpretation of that was that the Zanmirs were built at another point in their history when there was another value system in play, another set of things that they yep. valued. And then the Hist decide all of a sudden, oh, we're going to convert.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe they got away from the Hist for a while and weren't listening for whatever reason, and then the Hist had to, you know, say knock that off. I don't know. It is a mystery.
Yeah, and I think we've got at least two distinct Argonian subcultures existing in Oblivion in various ways, because we've got the ones in Cold Harbor and the ones in Clavicus Vile's realm at the moment. I don't think that they've broken off and formed Umbriel yet, so we've still got all that to come. And so there's definitely all sorts of bits that can be dug into as the different types of Argonians since. And you've also been very, very careful to say this is a myth from one tribe and not otherwise
exactly
tested.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's one thing Lawrence, you know, made very clear too before he left is that, you know, the idea that there's this monolithic culture that all Argonians ascribe to is ridiculous. That just doesn't work. The only kind of pan-Argonian idea, I think, is just this idea of change and the kind of, you know, just having to go with it in whatever way seems appropriate. And also this idea of radical forgiveness, which, you know, if you have a society that's full of all these tribes with, you know, disparate ideas about what you should do, and it hasn't, you know, just collapsed on itself in, you know, constant perpetual war, there must be something there which kind of keeps the peace or whatever. And I think the idea of the virtue of forgetfulness, I think, is something that is cool, because I mean, people get so caught up in, you know, holding on to things and you know, saying things can't change, and if you just say no, it's okay to let that go, let it pass, you know. I think that there's something profoundly healthy about that, and I think the Argonians are kind of the only culture that have figured that out, which because everybody else gets so stuck, I think.
I'd argue maybe the Bosmer as well.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because they seem to be much more accepting of outsiders, and at the very least, I don't know about acceptance of change as such, I suppose. Because they're sort of still very hidebound by tradition, so to speak, because you've still got the Sylvanar and the Green Lady and all that structure. But because everything's per chance with the Bosmer and so on, and that, again, they're sort of edging towards that sort of overall acceptance and, yeah, we can let it go. And I think, actually, in the more modern retabular, like, history, the Argonians are possibly swinging away from that idea a bit.
Oh, with the Antaliel and stuff?
Yeah.
It's, that's one of those interesting things, is trying to figure out how that works, right? how do you go from this, you know? Well, and it's kind of talked about it a little bit in the Blackwater War books, is how do you have this kind of culture that in very, like, very rapidly can become very scary, right? Like, people, I mean, you have the whole Argonian slave narrative during, you know, and we definitely wanted to get away from that during Merkmire. We wanted to present, you know, like, Argonian culture separate from that whole part, which is unfortunately it kind of become one of the central pillars of, you know, people's, how they identified Argonians was this, like, but then you think about, like, once the, you know, the whole Anzalil stuff happens and, you know, conquering huge swaths of, you know, Tamriel or whatever, you're like, well, shit, where did that come from? You know, like, we didn't know we had it in them, right? Like, I mean, you know, the idea that they charged into Oblivion and, you know, pushed out, you know, pushed all the Oblivion gates closed and stuff. I always thought that was really cool. But yeah, I mean, it's how do you go from, you know, fun, pastoral, kind of lay in the mud, everything's cool and groovy, to, like, we're gonna, you know, like, become this incredibly warlike, you know, people. And I think that some of it's got to do with the Hist, right? I mean, either the Hist thought that needed to happen for whatever reason, or maybe there was a concerted effort to ignore what the Hist was saying. I don't know. It's really interesting. It's a very interesting period in Argonian history. I'm really interested to see where that goes if we keep moving forward in the time.
Yeah, well, I'm a little pessimistic about that, because I'm pretty convinced that Tez 6 is going to be happening quite a way away on the other side of Tamriel. So quite how much...
Yeah,
so we'll probably only get glimpses of that,
right,
as we go through the other games, but we'll see. That's all in the future. And I did have a train of thought that I was going to go on about the Hist and so on, but no, it's gone.
That's okay.
And I think that's pretty much everything that I wanted to run through. It feels like we've gone through everything at a bit of a breakneck pace, but is there anything else that you want to talk about?
I can talk more. The whole thing about in your podcast, I thought it was really interesting that the whole thing about the contrast between kind of the Patamaic values of the Chimer and Velothi stuff versus the Inuic stuff in Clockwork City. So I'm happy to talk about that too, because I think that's really interesting.
Okay, so just to pick up on that Anuuk Patamaic thing, then, it's almost a term that I don't like, the Anuk versus Padmaic side of things, because in my opinion, Anu doesn't really act Anuic, and Padmaic doesn't act Padmaic, so at the very least, they're mislabeled.
in what way? Lay it on me.
So in the Anuad, Anu is desperate to get back to how things were. He wants to recreate Nir as close as he can, or what Nir created, which was the 12 worlds, so he's not wanting things to be static. He's wanting to go backwards.
Sure.
Whereas Padme doesn't particularly want change. Padme just wants to have Nir for himself. Being Padmaic isn't being like Padme, is being selfish, in my opinion, as opposed to actually wanting change. I don't know. I'm just not happy with Anuic and Padmaic as descriptive of stasis and change without a few qualifiers, I suppose.
Right. It's tough. I mean, all those dualisms, just by virtue of the fact that they're dualisms, 99 times out of 100, it's BS, right? Like it's sloppy thinking. It's basically saying, like, I'm going to take this incredibly complex world or these incredibly complex, concepts. I'm going to distill them down to these two opposite things. And then that's how the world works. I think that's, it's always more complicated than that. It has to be. So, I think it makes complete sense that Anu and Padme might be behaving oddly because, I think they're bigger than what we say they are, I don't know. I think that stasis and change are, they're very important concepts.
Yeah.
Even if they don't necessarily correspond with how those forces work in practice, I feel like those two competing ideas are really inform a lot of the cultures for sure. I think it's one of those useful binaries that isn't necessarily true.
It's a useful tool, so to speak.
Right. Exactly. So with Sothisiel, he comes from a quote unquote kind of Padmaic tradition. Exactly. Chimer, right? Like that was their bag. And, I think there's a specific rejection of Azura at one point where he's basically like, done with that. We're going to be the gods that you guys can't be or won't be or whatever. And I think that in and of itself, is kind of, turning the back on, those forces. I think that pushes him. I think Sothisiel's story, for me personally, is I've always had a hard time reconciling the idea of Clockwork City or the idea of order or kind of a unified purpose or any of that stuff. I have a really hard time getting that to work in a Padmaic context. Like it's tough. I don't know how you do that. And the idea of a clock, right? Just like a clock is, when I was thinking about it, I was like, it's a really cool, it's a cool thought experiment for Anu and Padme generally, because it's this thing that always goes in circles and it doesn't move of its own accord, but there are things that are always moving in it. There's change built into the system constantly, but it's like change that doesn't change. It's like change that's reliable or that just kind of keeps going in circles. And I think there's something really fascinating about that.
It's a paradox machine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I think that idea kind of gets into most of the stuff with Sothisiel, is this weird kind of paradoxical binding of, change and stasis and trying to make some sort of coherent whole out of those ideas. And Tamriel Final, for me at least, is the idea of taking a mess and turning it into something that's whole and perfect and works exactly the right way. If you look at, again, I said that I thought about Republic a lot when I was writing some of this stuff. And the idea of Republic is, it's a tremendously Anuic enterprise, right? You can't have, you can't have Utopia, because if Utopia changes, it's not Utopia anymore, right? Like, because it's already, you can't get better than that. So, I think that just when you talk about clocks, when you talk about perfect order and things winding and working in the right way, I think that you can't talk about that without a degree of Inuit language. And I think that you know, the idea that you can bind those ideas together, if you can pull in a very Inuit idea but still preserve the idea of change, the necessity of change, you get a cool outlook on things.
And one of the big things that raised to me was kind of totalitarianism and that sort of thing. I'm thinking back to an article I read years ago, but talking decades, but well, not decades plural yet, but it was about the philosophy of the colors in Magic the Gathering, if I can just diverge entirely for a few seconds.
Yeah, go for it.
Before we kick off, do you know about that world setup?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. The idea was that everyone working towards the common good, being part of a holistic system, and everyone being kind of pure and knowing where they fit, is very, very white. But then again, fascism is also very, very white.
Right. So, yeah, I gotcha.
Because there will be that sort of perfect order, everyone will be in their place, and everyone working towards the common good, kind of soldiering on for the good of the Volk and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
And Sothisil kind of reminds me of that sort of thing. He strikes me as a white villain, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, I was always surprised by, I mean, I'm not surprised that people like him because he's a cool character, but I am sort of surprised that people they think he's such a great guy. you could make an argument, I guess, that he's, I mean, sort of that he's preferable to the other two, kind of, but I don't know. I think that he's tremendously flawed, and I think that some of the things that he does are not great. not at all. And it's always surprised me that people come down so hard on Almalexia.
Yes.
And like so hard. And it's like I feel so bad for her because she's busting her ass for so long trying to make everything cool for everybody and like, you know, actually acting like a someone who actually like cares about what's going on and trying to, you know, do the best for her people and stuff. And then, you know,
can I pick you up on a word there?
Yeah, I think I know what it is.
You said she was acting like she cares.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I think I'm very keen on Almalexia. I think she gets a bad rap. But I think if you really think about what Sothisil was up to, or think about the way that he lives, I think it's less. I mean, he's absolutely prepared to let people die in pursuit of what he sees as the good. And I mean, the jury's out, right? Like, is what he thinks is the good actually the good? I don't know. I can't see that far into the future. I mean, you know, what happened in the Clockwork City and what happens with the Dunmer might become instrumental to something at some point. The kind of, you know, washing his hands of all the various sins that he needs to commit in order to do that. I mean, he feels bad about it, but he's still doing it, right? Like I think Almalexia gets a really bad rap, and I think he gets off a little too easy. But that's it. That being said, I love both of them. That's part of the reason I love the Tribunal so much, is because they are so thoroughly flawed.
I'd almost say that I'd like to see Almalexia's long form books, but I think we more or less already have them, if I can put it like that, because we have like the homilies and all the little fables and stuff that get attributed to her. She's more cultural, if I can put it that way, and she's trying to get under the skin of your average Joe in a way that Sothisil and Vivek don't really try to.
Exactly. Yeah, I think she's of the Hoi Polloi, right? Like, I mean, it's kind of trying to like, and I think there's value to that, right? Like, I mean, you can't, as much as I love the 36 lessons, like you're not going to hand that to some Dunmer kid and say, you know, hey, this is everything you need to know about, you know, the world. It's like, it's, you know, she's there to actually, for, you know, provide a foundation for people to build on. And, the only thing with her is I think that like, I think that she's fundamentally incapable of telling the truth in a way that Sotha Seal and Vivek can. Because, I mean, I don't know. I think partially because the truth is really scary. And also because the, you know, when you tell, if you've kind of appointed yourself to guardian of the common people and you live in this incredibly horrifying existence that's, you know, could be, you know, infiltrated by Daedric forces anytime or whatever. You don't want to hand that to some Dunmer kid and say, yeah. So I think that, yeah, I think that she's not as truthful. But I think that she's working her ass off and really, you know, doing the work. She's putting in the work in a way that the other two don't. Mm-hmm. So very keen on Amalixia. Yep. Everybody give Amalixia, give her a break.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and so. I think unless we want to go off on some huge, great tangents, I think that's probably about it. I could quite happily just pluck some more things out of the air and we will be here for another few hours, but that's probably not the best of ideas at this stage. But yeah. Right.
I can tell you there's stuff in the books nobody's seen yet.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm really surprised. I'm like really surprised. It's funny. I keep one every day. I wake up and I'm like, you know, I'm like, I wonder if they're gonna figure that out yet, and nobody has. So give it another glance. You might find something.
Ooh, yeah. Okay, so we need to go back through that with a bigger, or finer tooth comb, rather. Words, but yeah. And actually, that's another thing. What sort of ideas have you seen out there in the community that you haven't expected? I know you mentioned the idea that you're ambiguous intentionally in order to generate those sorts of ideas, mm-hmm. but what sort of stuff has totally blindsided you from what you've seen?
Oh boy. There was, you know, the Truth and Seeing has kind of fallen off the radar recently because we just have so much other stuff going on, you know? There was a lot about it early on. But yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff. Ice Fire Warden wrote a, like, I don't know, it was like a doctoral thesis on it. And it was tremendous. There's so much stuff in there, that made me kind of look at it again and say, wow, you know, gosh, you could totally get some of that stuff out of there. You know, some of the talks on the Tesla Reddit, about, you know, what X, Y, or Z meant.
And that was about where the audio cut off and our technical difficulties set in. I did manage to get Lehman back, but by that point we couldn't remember where we were, so we just called the interview there. I just wanted to say thank you ever so much to Lehman for agreeing to be interviewed and coming on and having a chat with me about pretty much everything. I'd absolutely love to have you on again. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, but we just need to find a decent excuse, something where we can go at things a bit more structured maybe than we did at that point. But, and I also want to say thank you to Gina Bruno for organizing the interview. Thank you, Gina, for your infinite patience and trying to juggle everyone's schedules. It was just a fantastic experience and I hope you guys enjoyed it. And that's about it for this week. Thank you ever so much for listening and please join us next time where we will be picking up our thread on the things happening in High Rock and asking who were the Daironi and why were they so important. Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and hosted by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.
Hey friends, this is Robots, the creator of the Robots Radio Podcast Network and host of the two original shows on the network, the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. These two shows have rocketed up the iTunes charts. They both together have over 150 five-star reviews in only a couple of months, with bite-sized episodes that take you step-by-step through the background of the games and the game worlds. They're thought-provoking, well-produced, and a lot of fun. I recommend you go check them out at robotsradio.net or on any podcast reader, podcatcher, whatever you use, iTunes, Spotify. Again, that's the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast, available everywhere. Hey, I'm Tom.
And I'm Stuart.
And we're from the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.
We talk about all things connected to D&D lore.
And we're on the Robots Radio Network. So if you're into Dungeons & Dragons or you're into lore, then come check us out. You can find us on any podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get podcasts.
Roll more dice.
That's the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.
Are you an avid player of The Elder Scrolls Online and looking to take your game to that next level? Well, the Red Diamond Courier podcast is here to help. I'm Bob Chachinski.
And I'm DogBark24.
We are two experienced players aiming to help others learn and improve through in-game knowledge and references.
From PvE
to PvP
and everything in between.
There's sure to be something for you in the Red Diamond Courier.
We hope you check us out. Thanks.